At long last, ladies and gentlemen, season 5 of Chewing the Gristle is indeed upon us. A convivial conversation fest between myself, Gregory S. Cawk, Esquire, and a variety of musical potentates from hither and yon. Brought to you by our friends at Wildwood Guitars and our friends at Fishman Transducers, of course, both of which I've had long-standing and continuing relationships with, and I'm very grateful for their continued support in this endeavor to bring you Chewing the Doggone Gristle. We've got a bunch of fun guests, some you have heard of, some maybe not so much. It'll be a little bit of discovery and a little bit of chaos all rolled into one. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Now, without any further ado, let's chew some gristle. This week on Chewing the Gristle, the immortal Jimmy Hall, vocalist, harpist, saxophonist extraordinaire of Wet Willie fame, Jeff Beck fame, and as a recent contributor to the Allman Betts family revival, the mighty Jimmy Hall, ladies and gentlemen, this week on Chewing the Gristle. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to yet another installment in Chewing the Gristle with yours truly, Gregory Cawk. I'm here with a legend and one hell of a cool cat, Jimmy Hall. You've seen him and heard him with Wet Willie, Jeff Beck. I saw him years ago with the Dickie Betts Ensemble at Milwaukee's Summerfest. Two nights in a row, I'll never forget it.
Oh, yeah.
And I've had the good fortune of being able to perform and hang out with Jimmy on the last couple of years on the Allman Betts family revival shindigs, and it's just been a joy. Jimmy, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Good to see you again, and excited just to be talking to you.
Likewise, my friend. Now, where do we find you today?
I'm at home in my sanctum sanctorum here, full of clothes and musical equipment and harmonica, saxophones, microphones, percussion equipment, keyboard, just a lot of stuff here in one room, but this is where it all happens.
All the accoutrements needed to do what Jimmy Hall needs to do.
Right. I'm wearing my reading glasses, so that's okay.
Excellent. Well, let's talk a little bit about you. You're such a great raconteur. We had a good time over many delicious meals during the Allman Betts excursion, talking about this, that, and the next thing. I was fascinated just to hear about your kind of your formative years being down in Alabama, and you know, kind of like my folks weren't real enthused about me engaging in musical activities initially. I mean, they liked the idea of it, but when you know, the profession of it comes to mind, they're like, wait a minute. I think I asked you how you ended up in Macon, and you just said, well, illuminate that if you could.
Okay. So my roots go back to a small town in Alabama. Actually, I was born in Birmingham, which is a larger town. And I guess I was about two years old. When we moved to Mobile on the coast, as far down as you can travel on I-65 down south. And that's where I grew up till I was 21 when we moved to Macon. So that whole trajectory was a childhood in a small southern town on the coast that was 2.5 or so hours from New Orleans and an hour to the beaches, and not a whole lot going on. I mean, there was music, and we heard all kinds of things, a lot of R&B and soul and old rock and roll and blues. And my dad, he was a musical. My mom sang, and she had a beautiful voice and sang in high school, and then later on in these female barbershop quartets called the Sweet Adelines. And she played piano. She could play the boogie woogie and the stride and the blues and kind of stuff, but she liked to play gospel too. And we would sit around the piano with her and harmonize. I got 5 siblings, or I did have 4. We lost one, but So yeah, everybody pretty much could sing. I had three sisters and two brothers, and we'd gather around the old piano and harmonize and sing. And so music was encouraged. My dad brought a lot of cool records to the house. He didn't sing or really play, but he loved music. And we had a stereo. We had a way to play records and little small record players too. But anyway, he brought home all kinds of albums and all kinds of jazz and country. Loved Hank Sr. and oh boy, just so many of those guys. Oh, he loved this album, Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music with Ray Charles.
Oh yeah.
That was mind blowing. That was a concept that it just seemed so natural. Absolutely. To hear those songs sung by Ray Charles, who had Southern roots. But anyway, so through the years, there was music. I sang in different little plays. I was the lead character in the play musical HMS Pinafore in the fifth grade. So that kind of, I was Ralph Rexstraw in a horse. Kind of blue Navy outfit, English Navy. And I really felt something at that point that I wanted to do this more. And I was very comfortable on stage. Even the acting part, I don't know if I could do as much now with that, but it was a lot of fun. Standing on the stage there and everybody's really loving it. I wasn't a great athlete. I mean, I like to play baseball here and there and throw the football with my dad and things, but not in my wheelhouse or something. My dad was long and tall like me. And yeah, anyway, so I looked for music and got involved in music all through school. So I did that musical in fifth grade. In the sixth grade, they offered violin, and that was just one instrument that you know they offered once a week. Teacher came to my little grammar school, and I took violin lessons, and she really thought I had promise. Good ear really helped a lot, and just a love for music, and so I stuck with it for a while. At least that year. And then seventh grade, they offered band, and my brother was 2 years ahead of me. My brother, Jack, he was already in junior high school, and he picked the clarinet is what he was playing. And he said, you ought to try out or really think about the band, because they offer a lot of different instruments. And I said, well, I'm playing violin. He said, well, you should try something. My mom thought, she started talking to me about it and said, you know, Jim, I love the saxophone. I've always loved saxophone. Why don't you try that? Why don't you see if you can do that? So I did. And my folks bought me. So Mrs. Bassett was our band teacher, band director. And she kind of took me on as not her pet, you know, student or anything, but she wanted to help me out. So she said, I'll help you get a good horn. So she helped me buy a horn, and I didn't know anything about brands and what was great, but she found, it was a Selmer Mark VI, which is what everybody wants.
Right.
It's, you know, it's the best, and especially the vintage ones. But anyway, this was way back then, and she found me, a Selmer Alto, Selmer Mark VI, for a really great price. I mean, a steal. It had some work to be done on it, and we planned on that, but my folks bought it. And I can't remember. I think it was a steal, like $300 or $400 back then. But my dad said, and he wanted me, he said, you better take care of this thing and, you know, take really good care of it. He said, that thing costs as much as a used car. At the time, I said, all right. And I did. And I, you know, was my first horn, and I kept it a long time. But anyway, that started me learning music and moving into learning some music theory.
Sure.
Reading and playing jazz. I mean, they had a little swing band in even seventh, eighth grade, and we'd play some of the standards. And I could kind of improvise a solo just based on thinking about melodies and what I want to hear. So some kids couldn't do it. They had to read the notes.
Sure.
And how it says, okay, play a solo. Well, I could make up something because I sang and I could hear melodies. But so I stuck with that. And then into high school, started, well, listening to music and thinking about all these great, great bands coming out in the 60s, mid 60s, and so much going on. And so I had a band. My brother, of course, 2 years ahead of me, he started his first bands, and I would hang out at his rehearsals before I got a band going. And I go, can I sing one? Come on. I'll sing High Heel Sneakers or something. I know a few of those old R&B songs. Let me sing High Heel Sneakers. I get up there and sing it, and they say, man, you're pretty good. And my brother go, yeah, he's going to be doing well. So it kind of went from there. I started my own band. My brother had a band called The Vibrations. And
now, what did your brother play?
He started out, I didn't mention, he played clarinet in the high school and then bass clarinet. And then we still have this guitar, but he bought, or my dad bought it, a K acoustic guitar. And I swear it's still at my mom's house. And he learned to play. He taught himself how to play it. And he got these books, and we got all these folk music and just all kinds of songs, trying to learn a different pop songs and things like that. And we'd sing together, and he'd want me to sing lead, and he sang third above. And I said, you know, later on, I go, isn't that what bass players do? Play low, sing high.
That's right.
You know, but we learned to harmonize together at an early age. And and you know, my parents would have a party or have a gathering of relatives, and come on, Jimmy and Jack, you know, my brother named Jack. Jack and Jimmy, y'all come in here and play a song for the people, for your uncles and aunts and all that. We'd have to put on a show. But so yeah, my brother started a band, and his band was called The Vibrations, and one of their high points, they all bought these Beatles suits that I don't even know where you could buy them in Mobile, but they were like a gray iridescent with no collar, those collarless suit coats, and started to get that look. And their drummer, his first name was Johnny. He looked just like George Harrison. They were all growing their hair out some, but they were, you know, still in high school. But they got to open up for the Animals. That's what they wore. They wore those Beatles suits. And this was at the local auditorium, and they opened up for the Animals. And my brother had one of those Ampeg bass amps. It had a flip top.
The convertible.
The convertible. I thought that amp was so cool. And so when the Animals, Chas Chandler was the bass player.
Right.
He's having a problem with his bass amp. I don't know exactly what. So he said, can I borrow your amp? To my brother. And he said, oh, yeah, sure. No problem. So he just kind of got like starstruck. Like, man, that guy, he was so cool. He used my amp. And you know, he really appreciated it. But it just, later on, you just think about what he did in his career, right. You know, with Jimi Hendrix and all this kind of stuff he did. But that was really the kickstarter of it. And then my brother and I, we had separate bands. Then we joined forces and put a band together and played locally. And we get out and drive an hour or so away to a different place, Pensacola, Florida, had some good clubs, or over in Pascagoula, there was Johnny Smokehouse, which was a cool old kind of juke joint. And, but we picked the best guys we could in our area, including a guitarist who wasn't in Mobile when we first were there, but then he graduated from University of Alabama. About that time, his name was Ricky Hirsch, and he kind of he filled out our band as the one of the last choices we made was picking him as our guitar player. And he loved B.B. King, and he could play some blues and bend a note. I said, man, he's playing blues, listen to that. So that's what we started with when we decided that we were going. This was 1969 into 1970, that we wanted, okay, we were listening to everything on the radio, and we were buying albums like crazy. So much that was happening, Rolling Stones and Allman Brothers.
Right.
But when we found the Allman Brothers, that was our beacon in a way. That was our compass point that we said, that's where we want to go, Macon, Georgia. That's where the Allman Brothers are. On this new label,
Capricorn.
And Capricorn Records, and they put this record out, and it was just the coolest stuff. I mean, just think about the songs on it. And I listened to that record over and over. That stuff falling out here, over and over. Wore out the grooves and listened to Greg's voice and the songs and the guitar work and all that. Anyway,
right.
I said, let's see if we can hook up over there in Macon and get signed and whatever we need to do. So it just so happened my guitar player, Ricky Hirsch, was a fraternity brother named Frank Friedman. And Frank was in Macon and he was a guitar player and songwriter and become part of their kind of loosely put together rhythm section. At Capricorn, you know, some of the first guys that were pitching their songs, but they were playing session there. So he had his phone number. He called Frank up and he said, hey, I've got a group of guys. We're really on the determined, and our goal is we want to record, and we think Capricorn's is a perfect place for us. And Frank did what he could, and he talked to the heads of the label and said, they got these friends and trust me, they're going to be good. Cause I know all the players, and they set up an audition. So we packed our van up, drove over to Macon, and they wanted us to audition live. They had a warehouse / rehearsal studio there with all the equipment. I mean, pretty good PA and everything. So they said, okay, guys, why don't you just set your equipment up and set up like you're going to do a show and play. You know, we played probably 45 minutes worth of music for them and some originals that we were starting to write and kind of get the hang of writing songs together and some original arrangements of songs. And they loved it. I was Phil Walden,
yep,
the head of the label, and Frank Fenner was with A&R guy and his right-hand man. And they said, we love it. It's like American Rolling Stones. Because, I get these comments a lot from people all the time. And I didn't even back then. Did anybody ever tell you you look like Mick Jagger? I don't take it for granted, but you know, but he was one of my heroes, and he's bluesy and rock and roll guy, and what an entertainer! And
right,
play the harmonica. And that's one of the reasons I picked up the harmonica when I was about 16, 17. And so that was it. I mean, they were all in, and it took off like a rocket. We recorded our first album within a few months and put it out in 1970. Later on that year, it came out. And
so this is like 70-ish. So Dwayne was still around and all that kind of stuff.
Dwayne was still around, and Barry Oakley and all the original guys. And looking back, I just try to savor those experiences, right, and those is because they aren't around. And people, you know, what was Dwayne like? Well, Dwayne was so busy being the head honcho, being the driver of that train. I mean,
right.
I mean, he was the boss, and he had a vision, and everybody had their input, but he was definitely steering it.
His word was law.
Yeah. And I mean, he did a good job of what they were doing.
No doubt.
Thinking about songs and how they put things together, the different sounds of Dwayne's guitar and the slide that he played, and Dickie's melodic and all that he brought. So it was just, I mean, we were just soaking it up. Every show we played with them, we ended up, everybody out front. I was out front. I never, you know, it's just when they hit Elizabeth Reed, everybody just, you know, or either they just smoking a joint, you know. But that was a great kickstart for our band. And
well, just prior to that, I know your parents sounded like they were very supportive, you know, as were mine, in terms of, hey, you know, helping out with instruments and getting you all excited. But when you decided to turn pro, was there some consternation on behalf of your parents, or were they like, no, this is your thing, do it?
Yeah, they there was some things going on. I mean, we grew our hair like crazy, as much as we were just like, we're going to never cut our hair.
Which down south back then was a potentially dangerous situation.
Yeah. And we definitely got a few situations where we had to get out of there real quickly, or somewhere in a honky tonk or something. Anyway. My dad, he didn't like the long hair too much. And at one point, I mean, okay. We were six siblings. So it was about time that my brother and I moved out and give everybody else more room and more food. So my dad drew a line. He said, you boys cut your hair or put on your walking shoes and go. And we said, we're going to go. But the thing was, it never was. He was just being a dad who's like, come on. I mean, I make the rules and this is what it is.
Right.
But later on, everybody had long hair. I mean, right. This was, you know, within a few years, but that was just a piece of the move anyway. You know, we were ready to go but as things went, and I mean, by 72, this is fast forward from 70, we were playing Carnegie Hall with the Allman Brothers and my folks. That was probably one of the biggest thrills among many that happened, but it was kind of like, now you're talking. Okay, right. Now we get it. They sent a big bouquet of flowers. It was actually a big horseshoe of roses to the lobby of the Carnegie Hall. They couldn't come up that time, but they sent us some congratulatory flowers for the lobby.
Let's talk a little bit about in that period of time. I mean, bands were louder then. I mean, as a vocalist, how did you deal with hearing yourself, and was it just I mean, you know, especially when you're playing with the Allman Brothers, that original incarnation, I think every incarnation was not quiet. And I remember hearing something weird, like Greg Allman never really even used monitors, that he just used the mains. But talk about how it was different then as opposed to how people might perceive things now.
Well, yeah, the Allmans were loud, and they got louder through time. And after being around bands, maybe like Grateful Dead, who had walls of amplifiers, but they reached a point that I could. Dickie Betts got real loud. I mean, I don't know at what point it was. I talked to Jack Pearson about it, and he would say, "Man, those times I played with the Allmans, that's why I lost a lot of my hearing, because I didn't use earplugs, and Dickie was right in my ear, you know." But it was one of those things that I used earplugs when I could,
right?
Just that I wanted to, and everybody advised me, my mom or just people in the know, just say, "You be careful, that you don't want to blow out your ears." And
right.
And then along the way, I'm on stage with people like Dickie Betts. And, you know, we had this is fast forwarding some, a band in the early 80s from 82 to 84. Dickie Betts, myself, Chuck Lavelle, and Butch Trucks put this group together, and it was called BHLT. And it was Betts, Hall, Lavelle, and Trucks. And we toured all over, mostly East Coast and South. And that's when I noticed, I mean, Dickie was just really blasting out. So I was real careful with wearing earplugs, because but thinking about that, it's just like, I've been around some loud, Jeff Beck played pretty damn loud, but a lot of times I could be standing far away from it. And later on, really got into ear monitors, and that's been my saving grace too.
Yeah, the first time I saw you was at with that ensemble with Dickie and Chuck Lavelle and Butch Trucks.
Where was it?
That was at Summerfest in Milwaukee, and it was you did two nights, and on the second night, that football player John Matusak was there, and I remember he came on stage and he picked Dickie up. I remember it well. It was awesome. And had quite an effect on me.
I've got great memories. And I'm trying to remember if I did it ever with, some band things that I did along the way. One was the Nighthawks. It was a part of the job for me from 87, 88, 89, when Jimmy Thackeray had left. And Mark Winter is a friend, and he just said, "Man, why don't you come up and we're going to put together this group without, you know, Jimmy Thackeray." And we got Jimmy Knowles, who was right. in sea level,
right?
And played with some other people, too, like Alex Taylor and a few other people. But he was a great adjunct in that band. And so it was two or three years of kind of blues boot camp. I mean, we're playing a lot of the blues clubs everywhere, and then even going to Europe, and I don't think I went to Japan with them, but I did a lot of shows during that time. And Mark Winter was always kind of a mentor and his band leader, harmonica player.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just roots blues kind of guy. But, that whole volume thing, I work with Hank Jr. and it's been a good side gig just through the years. And we don't do that many shows, but just enough to be a helpful in my financial world. But,
sure.
I guess it was when he started hanging around with Van Halen and all these people, or Sammy Hagar, all these rock and rollers, and Dickie Betts too, that he decided he needed a big, huge amplifier. And he got one of those. He was endorsed by Peavey, so it's their version of a Marshall.
I think it was the Mace, the Peavey Mace.
Yeah.
A bludgeoning implement.
Yeah. Oh, he's still pretty loud, but I thank God for ear monitors.
We interrupt this regularly scheduled gristle-infested conversation to give a special shout-out to our friends at Fishman Transducers, makers of the Greg Kauk signature Fluence Gristle Tone pickup set. Can you dig that? And our friends at Wildwood Guitars of Louisville, Colorado, bringing the heat in the shadow of the Rocky Mountains. So I'm fascinated by the early days of Macon.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And just about the whole, I mean, not to, you know, go into total nostalgia mode, but, and, you know, kids these days type of a thing, but there seemed to be just, it seemed to be a lot more about the music back in those days. I mean, obviously, you know, commerciality and commodification and needing to make money has always been a part of it, but it seemed like there was a time where it was really about, you know, music and jamming and hanging with people and kind of a fellowship of just trying to be better musicians. And that's kind of the vibe I get of Macon. Is it a fantasy on my part, or was it like that?
No, it was like that. And the Allman Brothers kind of set the tone, and the fact there were the brothers and there was a brotherhood, but they mentored us in a lot of ways. And it's kind of like, here, let me show you what we do. Or like Barry Oakley tell my brother, I really like this. I can't remember what amps they were using, but he just said, you ought to try this amp. I think you really like it. And just really giving a helping hand. You know, it's cooperation, and it's collaboration and cooperation versus competition a lot of times. Right. And you really felt it. So we were the second band signed to Capricorn. And then we were on tour and ran into Marshall Tucker over South Carolina. And we just knocked out with them. In fact, they had two brothers. We were going, wait a minute, two brothers, two brothers, two brothers. And they had such a cool sound, a real mix of country and blues and jazz and everything. And we told them, we're going to help you get connected with Capricorn. And they gave us a demo tape, and we brought it to Capricorn. And then Capricorn took it from there and said, man, we love these guys. So they got signed. And so, you know, here it was, we were trying to help out them and help the label in a way. And of course they, you know, became huge success. Right. So there was a sense of brotherhood and let's help each other out. And we, Southern Rock Brotherhood, whatever you want to call it.
Now, in terms of, you know, you hear the stories now in retrospect that, you know, Phil Walden, from a business point of view, you know, there was some squirreliness going on there and so on and so forth with left people nonplussed. But, you know, you look back in a situation like that, is it more good memories than bad, as far as, you know what I mean, in terms of, boy, it could have been.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, Willie wouldn't have been what we were, and you know, like we got to work with Tom Dowd and even this kind of great crazy guy who was just a brilliant producer, but Eddie Offord, who was producing Yes and Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and I think the labels are thinking, well, this is American Rolling Stone, let's get some English producers, you know. So this guy, we kind of taught him more about funk and soul and blues than anything. But he was a good engineer and pretty fun to work. But Tom Dowd was the main. Yeah, we did two albums with him. And just what a guiding light and what a wonderful human being. And he just had a he just loved the music and he loved getting involved in it, and he had great ideas. So his idea on Keep On Smiling, he loved the song, and he thought, well, this has got potential. And he listened to the song and just kind of was pondering what it needed. And he said, you know, you got, the bones are good. You don't have a bridge or a real change up in here. You got three verses or four, whatever. And he took the last verse. He said, I got an idea. And it was the first time I heard, I guess it was, trust me. You're going, right. It's going to work. Just bear with me like that. So he said, the words were, you're just hanging out at the local bar. You're wondering who the hell you are. Are you a farmer? Are you a star? And I mean, you know, some people go, what does that mean? Well, I was living out in the outskirts of town and really wanted to get sort of back to the land hippie lifestyle. And I had this real gypsy lady girl that Amanda that I fell in love with, and we were going to raise our own vegetables and eat organically, and we were vegetarians, and all this stuff was going on. So, I mean, are you a farmer? Well, I was growing my own vegetables and out there plowing and digging in. And it was a peaceful way to go after being on the road and come, you know what I mean, kind of decompress. Where am I now? I'm going out on a limb here. What was I talking about?
You know what? I just...
bacon.
Yeah, the bacon thing. I just liked where you were going.
Yeah. Tom Dowd.
Tom Dowd. Yeah.
Those were those words. So Tom Dowd said, okay, we're just going to break down and we're going to, everybody's going to hit it with a, you know, a chord, or the drum just hit it hard. So, just hanging out on the local bar, and you're wondering who the hell you are. Are you a farmer? Are you a star? And after that, he said, just hit him with the chorus. Go home on the chorus and just, you know, we'll build it up bigger and all that. And we tried it, and we went, this is pretty.
It worked.
It's going to work. This is really good. This feels right. And that became a real trademark in the song. But that's just one of the things was about him. He really worked with the vocalist really well and try to get you to put the emotion in it and think about the lyrics you're singing. And he liked our female singer. My sister Donna was a Williette, and we had Williettes before there were Honkettes of Lynyrd Skynyrd and some other groups. But he loved that vocal sound and brought them to the front and to the fore and featured them on several songs. And Smiling had that real gospel chorus on it, and there were songs where, oh, I did a duet with my sister Donna on one called Take It to the Music, and a duet with our other female singer named Ella Avery. And I wouldn't trade the experience for anything. He did two albums for us, and they're some of my favorite times of being in the studio.
Now, did you do anything with Johnny Sandlin while you were doing the Capricorn thing? I had some fun with Johnny back in the day.
Yeah, we did a live album after we did two studio albums. We did a live album recorded at the Warehouse in New Orleans, and Johnny was the producer and engineer on that album, and we were open for the Allman Brothers, and I think Elvin Bishop was on the label, on the show also. But it was at the Warehouse, which was a pretty historic venue in New Orleans.
Right.
So they tore it down eventually, but everybody loved it. It was one of those where you sat on the floor. It was just a big, it was called the Warehouse. It was a big warehouse. And they had all these rugs, oriental rugs or whatever, sitting on the floor. And they had all the big names coming in there, but the Almonds liked it there. And just a great place. But we recorded that album, and that became we got a lot of notoriety from that. Everybody said, Wet Willie's live is a live band. You got to hear them live. More energy. And the next year, so that was 73. Okay. The beginning of 73 is when we released that album. So we just recorded it back at New Year's Eve, going into 73. So the album came out and we wanted to do a tour. Oh, we did, tried to tour every spring. And we got a call from Jeff Beck's management. And they wanted Wet Willie to open up a tour with Jeff's trio called BBA. So that was more official introduction to Jeff Beck was during that tour.
And, which must have been awesome.
It was awesome just to watch Jeff do what he does, and jaw dropping going on a lot. Just couldn't believe what he could do live and just make sounds that nobody could out of with a guitar.
Right.
By the end of that tour, well, I was jamming some with them, and Jeff would say, come out and sing one, or we just do some blues or whatever. Just come sing Blues Deluxe, I would do that, and he'd like my heart playing. And so by the end of the tour, he was already talking to me about collaborating. He said, "Make me shake my hand on this." He said, "We're going to make an album together at some point." Soon, I hope. I said, I'm in, whatever happens. So what happened was he stayed in touch in the interim, but that was 73. It was 84 before I got the call to go record with him. But it did happen. And it was the Flash album. And Nile Rodgers produced that. They were at the record plant in New York. And, wow, there's a lot to that. We can talk about hours about this, the history of it. But I don't want to toot my own horn or whatever you want to call it. But just the fact is that looking back, we lost Jeff. I was at his funeral and got to sing some it's been pointed out, and I knew this anyway, but as far as Jeff Beck with a vocalist, he had Rod Stewart, and he had Bobby Tinch. There's some other people, too, that worked with him, but I'm the one who was there the most, and especially in later years, it started in 84, we did a tour of Japan. It was in 86 after that album came out. But then all through the 2002 and 2005, I did some dates with him. But then it rolled into 2014. I kind of rejoined him for a good while. So 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19, I was involved in his tours. Even when Johnny Depp kind of got in there with us and that was just what it was. But that was the tour in 2019 was when Johnny first came out and did a few shows with us. But I was proud to be a part of that whole run of years and wonderful shows. And Jeff was a mentor and a great friend.
Well, interestingly, I mean, Jeff, always got better. And it seems like, you have like the taken of the fountain of youth. I mean, you're the top of your game. You're singing like a madman. You command the stage. You know, it's just, I mean, there's a lot of symbiosis there. So how have you managed to, I mean, you mentioned earlier, you know, you kind of had this period of time where you were vegetarian. And have you always been mindful of your well-being as opposed to a lot of your contemporaries who were just like, let us pillage at all times?
I have a moral compass or a whatever, guardian angels. Now my parents were just good-hearted people and thoughtful, and they're, you know, Southern, but just a good part of Southern, whatever you want to call that. To teach you right from wrong. And just looking back at the whole period of the 70s and coming up through that with drugs around and some loose females, right. a proliferation of women. But I would try to steer clear, even when the almonds went in some darker places with some of the drugs. It just felt like a dark place. It felt like it was evil. Anything
yeah, they were on. I mean, all the things I've read, of course, only from readings, but it's like they were into like heavy duty narcotics, like really yeah. early on.
Opioids. I mean, they dabbled in cocaine and then got involved in the other stuff. And it that's what I'm saying. I just was around it and knew that I did not want a part of it. And then I was around bands like Aerosmith, Steven Tyler, and Joe Perry. They befriended us. We opened up some shows with them, but they were zombies, unfortunately, in a certain period. And I've seen them since. And I mean, they, you know, it's great. They came through it. But I just knew when something didn't feel right, I just steered. And I think that's why I'm here still. And I was watching my diet and reading all these books on health and natural foods and eat vegetables and fruits and all from back in the 70s. And then I found a woman that I'm married to now for a good long time. And she's in the medical field.
Ah.
And she's a nurse practitioner and she is a really health conscious person. So it's just good to have that around. And she helps me watch my salt and my fats and fried foods. And I'm always a kind of tall, lanky guy, but you know, if I eat too much of the carbs and all this, I can get that kind of soccer ball in the stomach look.
Yes, I understand.
That's where it goes. And but I'm just really blessed and fortunate. I was raised in a Christian family and just have some beliefs about the master plan and I don't know.
It's trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, doing the right thing. Just the basic morality and treat people like you want to be treated. And if you're a musician, that way they'll call you back or, you know, you've got relationships. And nurture them, and that's what I've always done, and it's opened a lot of doors between and a big helping a big amount of God-given talent that I don't take for granted. And as I get older, I'm just joyful and blissful and happy that I can get out there and belt it.
Yeah.
And belt with a fervor.
Yes.
That word.
I can attest to it.
and passion. And I love, you were talking about being out on the Almond family. I've done it 7 years, and Devin's great about choosing a variety of guest artists, and sometimes the younger ones that I think he wants to give them a chance and their chance in the spotlight and help mentor them. And we do that. And on this last tour, I don't just say, hey, if you guys want, I can give you some pointers, some ideas about your singing. And just let me know. And so Tal Wilkenfeld and Allie Venable and just different ones. Even Dwayne Betts would ask me, you know, because he's want to be more confident and powerful as a singer. And so if I could help, I did. And they thanked me for it. But it's, to me, it's like they're getting there. But you know, I could see how you could improve, and this is what I think, you know. So when people help me, you know, just like to help you, they see that you're going to go for it, so they're going to help guide you get how to get there.
Exactly. So it seems like you keep very, very busy. It seems like you're always doing something. Is this is it you love doing it, and so you're like, I'm going to do it until I drop, type of a thing?
Yeah, you know, musicians don't retire a lot. It seems like you can just back off if you want. I like to travel. I like most aspects of travel. Seeing new horizons, new scenery, beautiful scenery. The natural world. And my wife and I think a lot of people maybe lean toward travel when they get into their golden years or whatever you want to call it. But that's what Karen and I want to do more of is, I mean, our kids are grown and, you know, we're still close to all of them, but we're going to get out and see more of the world. And a lot of that, I'll just be playing shows if I can book them there where I want to go. But, I like variety. Sometimes it's playing with different, I'm opening shows. Got a couple shows with Dave Mason. I'm looking forward to that in latter part of March. I still do the Blues Bender.
Right.
Been an annual thing in Las Vegas. The cruises are fun. I do those, and you know, I'll bring my wife, or I'll bring one, or however many of my sons want to go. I might bring my sister Donna will come and sing with us, or my wife and one or sister to come. And that, you know, it's a family thing a lot of times, but I do two or three cruises a year, these music cruises.
Right.
And
those are fun. I mean, I did my first one last year, actually. You know, you were on it with the Bonamassa cruise. And I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I mean, you got to think about, you're going to be on a boat with your fans, and you can't be antisocial, or you be like, I can't talk to you right now. You get stuck in an elevator with them, and you're just people.
Right. Yeah, I've got no problem with any of that. I have no problem with conversing with the peeps. And I have no problem with buffets either. So they're... Especially of the 24-hour variety. That's always a nice touch.
For the people that... I mean, I'm not much of a drinker, but... There are people that go, well, hell, I can go get loaded and don't have to drive. I know what the cabin is. I can stumble back there, but anyway, they're a lot of fun. And I just did Sandy Beaches, which is Sandy Beaches Cruises. Deborah McClinton started that one years ago. And I've been doing that one since 1998, the first one. And then I did one called the Big Easy Cruise back in the fall of last November. I've done Joe's Bonamassa's Cruise a couple times. And I did one called Rock Legends. I haven't done that but one time. And one called Southern Rock. They did that. Star Vista helped put that together. We did that a couple years. I think they want to bring it back, but anyway, yeah. I'm going to bring this up just real quick. This latest album, we started recording in 2020 and put it out 22. Anyway, I did it then with Joe, and he co-produced, and he had Josh Smith as his sidekick. Right. But it was a great experience and very, we put together some good songs, really good songs. Joe helped with that, and his playing on it was just magnificent. And I'm having fun playing that music for people, and now they're all saying, "This is some of the best work you've ever done. Keep doing it. We want more." And so that's what I'm thinking about now is the next step in the studio and writing and the whole creative process.
Folks, thanks so much for tuning in. We certainly do appreciate you stopping by and partaking in the most savory, chewable gristle this side of Cucamonga. Gregory Kauk, looking forward to seeing you again next week, even though I won't actually see you, but I'll sense your presence.